This podcast features criminologists discussing sensitive themes and topics. Listener discretion is advised. One woman's comeback from drugs and incarceration would lead her to a life of service in helping Indigenous families find their loved ones. This is the Lissa Yellowbird story. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Megan. How are you?
I'm good. Today's episode is my first one to celebrate Women's History Month, and I'm pretty excited about it.
I can't wait to hear what you have. Yeah, we didn't talk about the cases we were choosing for these.
We did not. We only kind of ran it by each other to make sure we didn't choose the same one, which I don't think we've ever done. I don't think we've ever chosen the same case. No. So that's good. We have different interests. Mm-hmm. But for me, today's story was inspired by a book I read with our wonderful book club called Yellowbird. And this was written by Sierra Crane Murdoch. So just briefly, Murdoch spent 8 years in an immersive investigation to deliver a true story of not just crime, but the cultural and historical underpinnings of loss, violence, and healing of people living on tribal lands. Her work is really incredible. And again, she devoted so much time living with people and really speaking to everyone in the community. It's a very, very insightful piece of work. So she actually began her own investigation in 2009 as she started investigating the Bakken oil boom of North Dakota, which basically put North Dakota only second behind Texas in oil production in the United States. So this kind of serves as the backdrop for our story. And for people who don't know, because I didn't know much about it, the Bakken Rock Formation also extends to northeastern Montana and parts of Canada, making it one of the largest oil deposits in the United States. Now, the oil boom surge of 2008, why then? Well, it stemmed from changes in technology. Mainly, I don't know if you remember this, but fracking, which is a practice that fractures the rock deposit to allow oil to flow. So this changed the way that oil could be mined. Now, initially, the oil boom was seen as a blessing to the impoverished residents living on reservations in the region. They thought now they'd finally see some profits from their natural resources. But the tribal members would not see profits, as it turned out, from the oil boom's success. It was the wealthy corporations who controlled the oil, and the consequences to those who should have benefited were really extreme. So instead of receiving the benefits, they were exploited. The land and people were exploited. The results were addiction, broken families, violence, and significant increase in crime. So not only does today's case stem from the outcome of the oil boom exploitation, but it extends way beyond just one crime, Amy, and just one woman, to an entire community.
You got me interested.
Good. I mean, that's the point. It was something a little bit unique for me, and I became incredibly interested as well. Before we get to these crimes, though, we have to talk about the woman who helped to uncover them and her remarkable story of resilience and transformation. Let's meet Lissa Yellowbird. Born in 1968 to Irene Yellowbird and Leroy Chase, Lissa Yellowbird is a member of the three affiliated tribes, which are the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara nations, who found their permanent home in western North Dakota in the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation. Lissa's father joined the Air Force before she was born and was not present then while her mother was pregnant and really for the rest of Lissa's childhood. So it was primarily Lissa and her mother, Irene. Except Irene was not a total constant in Lissa's life either. Irene was very ambitious, and she really wanted to work in academia, going to school in both North Dakota and Wisconsin before returning to North Dakota in the late 1990s as the only, get this, Native American professor in the state at the time.
Wow. What was she teaching? What subject?
I'm not sure what subject she taught. The book did reference it. I just can't remember offhand. So it was her mother's ambition that took her away from Lissa at times. Lissa lived with her mother off and on during Irene's pursuit of education. But she was primarily raised by relatives and I think at the time, Irene's mother, so Lissa's grandmother. Now, unfortunately, Lissa suffered sexual abuse at a young age, reporting that she'd been molested when she was just 4 years old by a caretaker, someone who I guess watched her when her mother was at school. And then she was sex trafficked in her teens and young adulthood during the beginning of the oil boom in the 1980s.
Was sex trafficking a part of that, or they were two separate? Like, I didn't know if sex trafficking was a byproduct of the oil boom or it was just a separate incident.
I'm not sure that I would say it was directly a byproduct from what I know, although with the oil boom, remember, crime rates did increase mm-hmm. on the reservations, and some of those crimes included sex crimes. Okay. So without knowing specifically, I can say that it wouldn't be a shock to see if the two were correlated. However, Lissa never told her family about these traumas, about being victimized. Now, Lissa also became a young mother herself, having her first daughter at age 19 and then going on to have five more children, I believe by different fathers who were not involved with their children, although Lissa does not talk very much in her own story or in Murdoch's story, Yellowbird, about the fathers. I just know that they weren't, or they were primarily uninvolved with their children. And while Lissa was in and out of abusive relationships and drug addiction, she worked hard to keep her family together. Now, her family was, her children were taken a few times by social services, but Lissa did not give up. She faced a lot of barriers, but despite the difficulties, Lissa pursued an education. Get this, getting a degree in criminal justice from the University of North Dakota, all while working to provide for her children.
That's incredible.
I know. And she was very versatile in this regard, Amy. Get this. Lissa worked as a carpenter. She worked as a bail bondsman, an exotic dancer, a prison guard, and eventually landed a job she loved, working as a legal advocate in civil and criminal matters for the three affiliated tribes.
This is incredible because she's working really hard. It doesn't sound like she has a, you know, a father figure for her children and she's providing for them. It's incredible.
I know. And dealing with a number of significant traumas mm-hmm. and really issues and setbacks on her own. But still, she was a fighter. Mm-hmm. Now, this job she loved was going well until an unfortunate tragedy occurred in the town where Lissa lived with her children. A train derailment caused a flood of ammonia to spread throughout the town, leading many people to fall seriously ill. One of the victims was Lissa's son, one of her children, who was in and out of the hospital over a lengthy period, about a year, during which time Lissa reported that she was absolutely exhausted. And because of all the time she spent at the hospital, she had to drop her advocacy cases mm-hmm. to care for her son and her other children. So struggling, she said that she had a friend at the time who introduced her to methamphetamines to help give her a boost because she was so tired. And unfortunately, Amy, like so many others we've seen, this was Lissa's downfall. Though Lissa had already shown that she was an addict as she'd started smoking crack when her youngest daughter was just 8 years old, now, by the time this daughter was 14, Lissa was severely addicted to meth, both using and selling with her boyfriend and the father of her youngest child at the time. Now, Lissa loved this man. She talks about him in the book, but found herself in yet another abusive relationship, severely abusive. Of course, he had good qualities. She talked about how at times he was very good with her children, and there were other parts about him that she loved. But he was very violent, and he beat her severely on many occasions.
He was also a drug user?
He was also a serious drug user as well, okay. who was extremely jealous and possessive as well. So the last beating, severe beating that she incurred from him was when her youngest was a baby, I believe about 16 or 17 months. In this altercation, he almost killed her. And he also threatened the lives of her other children. So this was the end for Lissa. But the breakup left her in an even worse place. Her addiction took over her life. And instead of celebrating her granddaughter's first birthday, Lissa was arrested for possession of meth with the intent to distribute.
That was her first arrest, though, throughout all of this.
No, it's not. Oh, it was okay. Not her first arrest. Okay. She had been arrested several times, but this was the most serious. Because, Amy, this was intent to distribute, which we know is more serious anyway, and this was in a school zone.
Oh.
In a school zone meant that it carried a mandatory 10-year sentence. And Lissa was convicted, and she began serving her sentence in 2006. One of the reasons, just so you know, that Lissa did not get a reduction, she was offered a reduction in her sentence to cooperate, or what she would call snitch on someone else, but she refused to do so. Now, Lissa was very lucky, though. One of the reasons, first, she did what a lot of prisoners do, and she got sober in prison. I don't know if this is a common thread for you, but a lot of the prisoners that I've worked with or interviewed said that in many ways, prison saved their life.
Absolutely. Yeah, you hear that very often. Okay.
Yeah, so Lissa definitely credits having been removed from society, partly responsible for her sobriety. But besides her sobriety, for reasons I didn't read in her book or elsewhere because I looked, Lissa earned release from this sentence in 2 years.
Didn't you say it was a mandatory?
Now, I did, and that's why it's so surprising, mm-hmm. because with a mandatory sentence, you usually have to serve 85% mm-hmm. of the sentence. I guess it varies a little bit from state to state, but she would have at least had to serve 7 years.
Yeah.
So this was a complete surprise. She was informed that she was being released early for good behavior. Hmm. I mean, there's any number of conditions that we don't know behind the scenes. It's perhaps that the prison was so overcrowded and they needed the space mm-hmm. for other offenders, maybe because of money reasons and resources. They decided to release offenders. Maybe they decided females were seen as less threatening. There's no way for me to know. But this was a surprise, and it was a surprise to Lissa, especially, like I said, given the fact that she wouldn't take a plea deal because it involved snitching on someone else. But Lissa had always been headstrong, Amy, and you're going to see, very stubborn. Now, after her release, she did not go straight home, as Lissa was paroled to a halfway house, which is very common for parolees who need help transitioning back into society. So Lissa spent the next 10 months in a halfway house in Fargo, North Dakota. When she was finally released from the halfway house in 2009, she found an apartment in Fargo. She insisted on staying there so that her sons, who lived mostly with her uncle while she was incarcerated, could be near her. So it seems that her family members really stepped in and cared for her children. Now, it was very hard for her to find a place to live because she had a criminal record and very little money. But she did find a place eventually through a friend, and the one she found required a lot of TLC. But Lissa did it slowly and steady. She said that she would go to work, come home, and she would, you know, do something like put up curtains. Or she did small things, painting here and there.
You mentioned one of her jobs was a carpenter. So she clearly was good with her hands and was able to.
She was very good mm-hmm. with her hands, and she was very capable mm-hmm. and she was very self-reliant as well. And as she rebuilt this apartment, or I should say, as she built this apartment and made it more of a home, one by one, her children moved back in with her. And it seemed that she and her family were rebuilding a life together. With her life seemingly back together, and we say seemingly because there's still a lot going on under the mm-hmm. surface, Lissa said that it was tempting at times to revert to drug use, but she did her best to stick to sober living.
What was she doing for work at this time?
She became a welder.
Oh, cool. That's very cool.
Yes. Again, she is someone who is so competent and able to find work in every field. And I believe welding, it pays decent yeah. wages as well. So even though it was difficult for her not to revert back to old habits, she was very determined. She continued meetings, or she attended meetings regularly, and she helped also regularly at the halfway house where she had spent her 10 months. As I said, she took a job as a welder, which gave her also financial means to help with her children and also to fix up the apartment. For a year after she'd been released from prison, Lissa stayed away from the reservation and mostly away from those who loved her.
Why?
But her eldest daughter convinced Lissa to visit her family on the reservation, and she reluctantly agreed.
Why was she estranged?
With her addiction, she had burned bridges, and I think there was a lot of judgment mm-hmm. of her in her family. or at least what she perceived. And she did return, but she said it was awkward at first. You know, it was awkward for some family members. She felt that some of them were looking at her like, is she going to steal from us? Mm-hmm. Is she going to do something? Is she still using drugs? But that wore away pretty quickly. And Lissa realized that her family still loved her very much. And she really began to reconnect with them. Not just with her family as well, but she said she found a really strong connection now to the reservation and the customs and the cultures. She found real significant meaning in that. Now, Lissa was also witness to this oil boom and the transformation of both the land and its people. So at this point, Amy, whether it was her worry about the possible exploitation of the reservation, her concern for those who nobody else seemed to care about, or her need to obsess over something to keep her distracted mm-hmm. and away from drugs, when Lissa learned about a young oil worker who had gone missing from the reservation, she became instantly interested.
Well, she also has a background in criminal justice as well, right?
She certainly does, yes, and issues of justice. At the time, the year was 2012, and it was the height of the boom. 29-year-old native Washington man Christopher Clark, known as KC, had come to work in the oil fields, which paid very well at the time. Now, KC worked for a trucking company where most of the wells were being drilled, but he was also the person who arranged contracts, among other things. On the day he went missing, KC was last seen by his coworkers at the trucking company office. And from what some who spoke with him had said, they thought he was going to take a trip to visit his grandfather in Oregon. But Casey never made it there, and nobody ever saw him again. Estranged from his mother, she didn't know how to get attention for her son's case, but Lissa Yellowbird did. She knew a lot of people, and she knew a lot of people, unfortunately, in this regard, or fortunately, that were involved in drug trade and other illegal activities, who often knew how to find people when no one else could. She also knew a lot of law enforcement from her own time in the system and working in these various positions, right? A bail bondsman, a prison guard. She was well connected in a lot of ways. So Lissa began speaking with Casey's mother, Jill, and then she began visiting places Casey had been, asking for information via social media. She was big in Facebook. And just asking anyone he'd been in personal contact with to speak with her. But even though she had these connections, I have to say she wasn't exactly popular with law enforcement or the tribal government members from whom she sought information.
Well, because she's getting into their business, they probably thought.
Exactly, yeah. She was digging in business about oil and the different companies and the dealings on the reservation. So she wasn't... Not that she, and she wasn't popular, but she also, some of her calls went ignored, we can say, from some of those people. But that didn't faze Lissa at all. She was dogged. Such was her way, and she'd found a purpose. So she was not going to give up. What she learned along the way because of her persistence was that Casey's boss, James Henriksen, and his wife, Sarah Creevely, who owned the oil company, were acting very strangely. They refused to take polygraphs. They gave conflicting information about KC. And they began to stand out to Lissa. Although she'd not yet found a specific reason, not a huge reason. And she had not uncovered any reason why they'd want to harm KC. He was an employee of theirs. And by all accounts, a pretty good one.
Were the police also looking at this couple in any way?
The police started to. So what I can say is that the police began looking at the couple. I don't know exactly when, but it seems to me that when the police became involved, it might have also been at the urging of Lissa, who kept making phone calls, kept letting them know these people are acting strange. The police were on to them as well, but I think Lissa was kind of a driving force in just pushing. One of the things she found out was that James liked to brag. He cut corners. He didn't seem to care about the land he worked or the men who worked it. Lissa made efforts to speak with the couple. And while James was not interested, she eventually earned Sarah's trust. She was very good at earning people's trust. And she gained some valuable information about the company from Sarah. It turned out James' business wasn't thriving. In fact, it was in trouble. Lissa had contact, as I said, with some law enforcement. Particularly, she had a contact with a Homeland Security agent and with local police who were investigating this case, but they also were investigating the recent death of another man who'd had a sour business relationship with none other than James Henriksen. Hmm. So I think that might have been what really brought them into the case as well. And remember, there are, we will talk about it later, but there are many, many jurisdictional problems with investigating these cases when it comes to tribal police, local police, state police, federal, a lot of issues that make investigations hard and stall investigations. What emerged from the police investigation from the death of this man? They were investigating his house and the circumstances. What one of the things they found was better than what they expected, and that was DNA. Even though we love the idea of DNA at a crime scene, it doesn't always happen. From there, the house of cards began to fall.
Megan, I'm sorry. Are you talking about the missing KC or the other missing man that was affiliated with the couple?
Yeah, sorry, not KC. Okay. The other man who was murdered.
Okay.
And the police were investigating his death. Gotcha. He had been found at his home. And in the course of investigating his home, they found DNA. Okay. And the DNA was linked to someone locally who had not been on their radar for anything else. But it also gave them enough evidence to confront this man who basically confessed eventually with some pressure. He confessed that he and another man had been hired by James Henriksen to murder KC because KC was going to leave the company and take many of employees. Basically, he was going to take employees with him, which would have left James destitute. I don't know if it really would have left James destitute. I think James had an ego, and I think he was very angry that Casey dared to think he was going to leave the company and take men with him.
Now, Megan, this man that was murdered, though, how is he related to Casey?
Yeah, he was also, just so you know, he was also involved with James, and they had a sour business relationship, and it did relate to Casey and other of these dealings.
Okay.
It seemed that James had, I don't know all the specifics about his murder, Amy, but it did seem that James, when he had a problem with someone, he seemed to be able to find someone else to take care of it. And I guess it seemed that murder was not out of the realm to solve his
business
problems.
Almost like establishing a pattern of behavior, would you say?
Yes, mm-hmm. and a plot. Yeah. I mean, there's multiple people involved, it seems. Mm-hmm. This man who was murdered was also had knowledge about KC's murder.
Gotcha.
Of course, James denied, he was confronted with this information, but denied any involvement in the crimes, as did his wife, Sarah. But at a later trial and with mounting evidence, James Henriksen was convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison in 2016. Sarah was never charged. Some people were very conflicted about that. Lissa always believed that Sarah knew things, knew more than she revealed, but probably wasn't involved in the murder plot. Some people described Sarah as completely innocent. Others said she was devious. Regardless of the opinions, there was no evidence that could be traced to Sarah. I also believe Sarah was given protection from James in the end because she did testify. Though the hitmen tried to take law enforcement out to find Casey's location because they did not have his body, unfortunately, he was buried deep in the Badlands. And to this day, Casey's body remains missing. And while Lissa Yellowbird may have been a thorn in the side of law enforcement, as many would say, her dogged investigation and pushy tactics were almost certainly one of the key ingredients for justice being served in Casey's case. Now, helping others to find their missing loved ones was hard enough, but for Lissa, this tragedy hit very close to home after James Henriksen's conviction. In August of 2016, her niece, Carla Yellowbird, went missing. And Lissa jumped into action right away.
How old was the niece?
I believe she was a minor. Okay. If not, she was close to around the age. She may have been a little bit older, around 18, 19, mm-hmm. but still quite young. Yes. Lissa began texting people, posting on social media, doing everything she could to help her sister find her niece. Her niece Carla was living in the town of Mandan, North Dakota, which is on the eastern border of Morton County, and it's a pretty populated city. Now, Carla had gotten involved with drugs, but she had also entered drug treatment on her own. Unfortunately, when she returned, so did her use of drugs. So she entered drug treatment on her own. She came back, but as we know, people come back to the same communities, the same influence. And so it's hard to escape the cycle of addiction. Now, Carla had been visiting Spirit Lake, an Indian reservation, on the day that she went missing. And this complicated things because the tribal police have jurisdiction over crimes on their tribal lands, not Morton County. So who was supposed to investigate this? Again, it wasn't complicated for Lissa, though. She wasn't law enforcement, and she didn't really care whose jurisdiction this came under. She heard rumors that Carla was last seen in a silver truck with three men at Spirit Lake. Remember, again, she had a huge network of followers on social media by this point, and people responded. And Lissa soon found out who owned the silver truck. She was working with a detective who also had the case in Mandan, and this detective welcomed Lissa's help. The two exchanged information, and Lissa put the names of the men suspected to be involved in Carla's case online. She put all three of their names. She made them public.
I guess that's the beauty of just being an ordinary citizen. You don't have to abide by any rules. You could just do that.
You do not. No.
Well, I guess she could get in trouble she could face civil suit for defamation for doing something like that.
It's not that I don't believe she said these three people kidnapped my niece. I believe she said these are the three people that were last seen with my niece.
Okay.
So I'm not necessarily sure you can get in trouble for that.
Okay, gotcha.
And her plan worked because she soon got a phone call from a man named Suna Guy, and he was one of those three men. He was willing to talk to Lissa, and while at first he denied any involvement in Carla's disappearance, Lissa wasn't having that. She urged him pretty roughly to tell the truth. But it would take several conversations and Lissa building rapport with Suna before he'd be willing to share any details. At one point, Suna was lying so much, and Lissa knew it, that she stopped playing friend and said she basically told Suna that he should call her back when he was ready to be honest and save his own ass. She hung up on him then. Now, she said this was an impulsive decision, and she wondered right after, was this the wrong move? Because she did not have a number or a contact for Suna, and she was relying on the fact that he would call her back. So this was a gamble. But it was the right move because Suna did call back, and this time he was willing to talk. He told her what Lissa had already feared and already, I think, knew, and that was that Carla was dead. Suna said that he had been there when the crime was committed, but he was not the shooter. The motive was drugs, he said. The men she'd met at Spirit Lake stole her money and drugs in a robbery gone bad. She asked him why her niece had to die, and he said that wasn't the plan. It just went awry.
I'm assuming she's sharing this information with the police.
She does share it with the police, yes. Suna also told Lissa that he'd spoken with the police at this point and that he believed he was in danger and that the men who had committed this crime or were with him were going to turn on him. So he was in hiding at this point. Lissa and Detective Bowman, who she was working with from Mandan, they drove up to Spirit Lake to meet Suna, who was hiding at a relative's house. With the FBI in at this point and the FBI helping as well, Suna was brought back to Spirit Lake, where he was able to pinpoint the place that Carla's body had been left. And he didn't lead police astray. They found Carla's body. Lissa was able to ID her niece via photos. The police didn't want her near the crime scene, but they did take photos and show her immediately, and I believe also through a tattoo and other identifying features. It was Carla. Suna and the other two perpetrators were arrested for Carla's murder. What wound up happening? One of the three perpetrators, Dalen St. Pierre, pleaded guilty to felony murder, saying that he only meant to hit Carla over the head with a gun, but it went off. He received a sentence of 27 years of incarceration for the crime. Dakota Charbonneau pleaded guilty to second-degree murder for aiding and abetting in the murder and other charges, for which he was sentenced to 50 years in prison. I'm assuming that he also had a criminal history that might have increased his sentence. But Suna also pled guilty in exchange for a 15-year sentence. Now, Suna was given a reduced sentence because of the fact that he cooperated. Amy, amazingly, Lissa spoke out on Suna's behalf at his sentencing. She basically told the court that they never would have found Carla mm-hmm. if Suna hadn't told them where she was.
That's why he got a reduction, right?
That is why he got a mm-hmm. reduction. But she was arguing for more of a reduction. She felt that 15 years was still too much. She felt that he also, because he was not, it was pretty much confirmed that he was not the shooter. And I think this was kind of a surprise to him as well. She believed because of his reduced culpability and because of his cooperation, he deserved less of a sentence than 15 years. Nonetheless, he still got 15 years in prison. And unfortunately for Lissa, this caused a serious rift with her family, who could not believe that she would speak out on Suna's behalf. To this day, if you watch interviews with Lissa, she still feels it was the right thing to do, and she hopes to reunite with these family members someday and mend the rift. But Lissa's biggest case came in the fall of 2017. 32-year-old Olivia Carey Lone Bear, a mother of five who lived on the Fort Berthold Reservation, seemingly vanished into thin air on an October afternoon. She was last seen driving her friend's teal Chevy Silverado pickup truck away from where she lived with her father and her children. Now, she had told her friends that she was going out that evening, but the last place she was seen was leaving the Sportsman Bar later that same night, which lines up with her going out. Olivia, I believe, had five children. She was known as a very good and devoted mother who was just trying to take an evening out for herself. Unfortunately, after leaving the Sportsman's Bar, no one ever saw or heard from Olivia again.
Does Lissa know this woman personally?
No, she did not know her personally. And though Olivia's family initially reached out to reservation law enforcement, they were frustrated, feeling that they were not getting enough help from police after filing the missing persons report. I will say, from what I saw, there were a lot of agencies involved, but there were, again, these limited jurisdictional problems. And it felt like the family couldn't get the exact support they needed from when they needed it. I think they were looking for more in terms of aerial support, water support, things that were complicated by all these different agencies. It did seem there was a response, but perhaps it wasn't the response that necessarily was needed. But Lissa had heard of Olivia's disappearance, and she stepped in quickly, Amy, mobilizing support from social media and helping to organize large-scale searches.
Now, is she,
which, by the way, became one of her specialties.
Is she also working as a welder, or is she moved into the, you know, formally moved into criminal justice?
Yeah, Lissa worked as a welder for quite some time, but she did say at some point it was just getting very hard. She had saved a good amount of money, and she was moving more full-time into rescue searches for families of missing women, not missing persons, men and women. So I believe that at some point she left welding behind to do this, to pursue this full-time. Okay. She wasn't paid in any capacity, mind you. This is all on her own dime. Now, Matthew Lone Bear and the rest of Olivia's family, they were incredibly grateful at first for Lissa's involvement. They said it came at a time where they were feeling kind of depressed and down and not so hopeful. Unfortunately, though, the relationship soured rather quickly. While it isn't entirely clear what exactly broke the good relations, some of the things said by Matthew and by Lissa indicate that they had disagreements over who was in charge, who was heading up the searches, where to put the resources from the community, because they were getting donations as well. And I suspect, Amy, that Lissa's headstrong attitude might have also rubbed the family the wrong way. You know, Lissa's very tough. She's not afraid of confrontation, and certainly she can rub people the wrong way. You might not call her instantly the most likable person, but she is probably the best person for the job. Nonetheless, even though a rift had formed without the family's blessing, Lissa was not going to give up on Olivia. It just wasn't in her nature to give up. Though they had initially pushed for water searches, they didn't get the resources they needed. And with the cold weather that hit North Dakota by that November, they were not able to search the lake. It was too cold. The lake freezes over. However, Lissa, she didn't forget this goal. And though it was several months later, about 7 months later, I believe it was, seven or eight, she came back to search Lake Sakakawea that summer. having a strong feeling that Olivia was located in the water.
When you say she went back, she goes by herself or she has like a search party? Like, is she doing all this on her
own? She has a search party. Yeah, they're volunteers, but she has a team. Mm-hmm. I'll talk about her. She has an organization and I'll talk about that in a little bit. So yeah, she went back with a team and they use sonar technology to scan the lake. And I don't know if you can believe this, Amy, but Lissa was exactly right because Lissa and her team found Olivia Lone Bear's pickup truck 21 feet down in the lake, about 400 feet from the shore and less than a mile from her home.
And she was also in there, the victim?
Yes. Okay. Unfortunately, Olivia was in there, but she was not found in the driver's seat. Rather, she was found. Remember, she had been seen driving away. Yeah. She was found in this waterlogged vehicle, buckled into the passenger side seat.
And nobody else in the vehicle?
There was no one else in the vehicle, but this meant at the very least that she had not driven the truck into the lake. So immediately there is foul play that's indicated here. It was a sad turn of events, of course, but it was the outcome that Lissa had expected, given how long Olivia had been gone. Unfortunately, Amy, the cause of Olivia's death is still undetermined as of 2024, and no suspects have been apprehended to date, so her case remains open. Her cause of death was, it was just hard to determine what it was at the time because of the condition of the body and how long it had been in the water. But fortunately, Lissa was able to get Olivia back for her family so they could properly mourn her. And while the pain they endure is certainly greater than most of us can ever imagine, the search for Olivia is over. But the searches for so many others are still ongoing, and Lissa Yellowbird continues to be there for them all. Okay, I talked about some of the significant cases here that Lissa has worked on, but there are many, many others. There's no end, Amy, or closure for the families whose loved ones remain lost. It's a phenomenon that I find hard to understand, and I frequently think there couldn't be anything worse than not knowing where your loved one is. Lissa Yellowbird understands this, and she helps whenever she is asked, and oftentimes when she is not asked. After her work on Casey's case in the early 2000s, Lissa has since formed the Sanish Scouts in 2013, and this is a volunteer organization devoted to helping families of missing and murdered Indigenous persons and those who've gone missing, in particular from the Bakken oil region.
Now, is she still just volunteering her time?
Yes, she does. She gets funding. They get funded to do, you know, resources for searching and resources for investigating, but she's not a paid, she's not paid. And by all accounts, she's run out of some money, you know. I assume she picks up work here and there in between to sustain herself, but this is her full-time mission. She's been involved in over 100 cases, and she's brought several of those missing persons, usually female and unfortunately not alive, back to their family members. Lissa's work has been hard, though, and it came at a great cost to her financially, as I said, but more importantly, emotionally with her family. In Murdoch's story, Yellowbird, you will read the strained relations that she had with her children for a very long time. In particular, her eldest daughter, they had a very, very difficult relationship for many years. Her daughter couldn't understand why her own mother, who missed out on all of her childhood, or who missed out on significant parts of her childhood and her own children's childhoods, would choose strangers over being then with her own kids, because Lissa spends a significant portion of her time working on these cases.
When her daughter was younger, though, she was struggling with addiction, so it was probably hard for her to be there, and now she's gotten the help she needs, right? I'm assuming she's no longer using drugs if she's able to do all this work.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. But that's her daughter's point. Mm-hmm. She was, she was an addict. She was in and out of prison. Her daughter was with other relatives. Now that she's finally sober, she thought her mother would want to spend most of her time with her family. Mm-hmm. So she and some of her other children did struggle with the idea that Lissa would then be spending so much time away from them. Mm-hmm. I will say she has come to terms with her mother's work, saying the following in the book. "I do believe she has a purpose in this world. I do believe that although she may not have been the ideal mom, her purpose is beyond being a mom. Mm-hmm. So it seems that her children have actually come to terms with it. And some of her children were incredibly inspired by Lissa's work and wound up going to social work or social services themselves. So now you could probably see why I chose Lissa for today's story. She is also a woman who turned her life around, but has become a leader in the movement of missing and murdered Indigenous women, bringing attention to these cases and bringing them home.
I also appreciate that you chose her for Women's History Month too, because a lot of the times we focus on women who have done reform on a larger level, maybe a federal level, yes, or have touched many, yes, more people. But it's important to recognize that there are so many women who are heroes in this area that are, you know, it may seem like they're only helping maybe a fewer number of people, but those people are somebody's brother, mother, husband, sister, father, right? So I think it's important to showcase, yeah, them as well.
I think so too. I'm glad you said that. Her work is part of a much larger systemic issue, as we know, and that is the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Now, we've both discussed some of these issues. I provided some of the statistics and numbers way back in episode, mm-hmm, 48, when I covered the murder of Deborah Black Crow O'Neill. But I think we should discuss them again briefly for anyone who maybe didn't listen to that episode, and because they bear repeating over and over again. Amy, I know you also recently covered an episode on a woman in this area, and I know that we discussed some of these facts and figures as well.
Yes, it was Kimberly Bearclaw Iron, and I believe it was episode 140. So we discussed a lot of these, but I think it's very important to keep discussing, to keep letting people know how pervasive the problem is.
From what we know now, numbers show that 4 out of 5 Indigenous women have or will experience violence in their lifetime. That's a very high number, more than the general population. Native American women are victims of domestic violence at 50%. They are murdered at more than 10 times the national average. And 1 in 3 are victims of sexual assault, usually at the hands of non-Indigenous men.
Those numbers are jarring.
The numbers are jarring. They are the most victimized group of women. According to the National Crime Information Center, 5,700 Indigenous women were reported missing in 2016, but only 116 of those were logged in the Federal Missing Persons Database.
Again, it goes back to the jurisdictional issue that we keep talking about time and time again when we talk about these cases. There needs to be some way that these jurisdictions can work together better.
I think so. Some of the root causes as well. We know that there are patterns of transient male workers like oil workers and miners and such setting up camps in remote places near the work, but that usually puts them near reservations and tribal lands. These places are referred to as man camps. I think we've discussed this before, but their inhabitants are isolated for very long periods of time with stressful jobs and long hours. It tends to cause a whole cascade of consequences, starting with substance abuse and leading to violence and crime against the women who live near them. And as you said, these places often fall between jurisdictions, at least the tribal lands do. So it becomes an issue of some of these lands are federal, while some come under the jurisdiction of the state. It also depends on who the perpetrator and victim are, because jurisdiction varies according to whether someone is Native American or non-Native American. Also, or further complicated by tribal officers who have some power to detain serious offenders for a limited time, but after that, it's up to local, state, or federal law enforcement to take over, which often does not happen. Mm-hmm. But Amy, the encouraging news is that Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women organization and movement is finally getting some real attention, with several advocacy groups emerging. There's also more press interest, as well as some other encouraging changes. So major studies conducted by the National Institute of Justice and Health Institute provided those numbers I referenced above about women who were not reported or included in databases. So the response has been that the Department of Justice and the Bureau of Indian Affairs created a new database that will absolutely include and track missing women from tribal lands, no matter where they are. Couple other things. In 2022, President Biden signed the reauthorization of the VAWA Act. That's the famous Violence Against Women Act. One of the new provisions was, quote, to expand special criminal jurisdiction of tribal courts to cover non-Native perpetrators of sexual assault, child abuse, stalking, sex trafficking, and assaults on tribal law enforcement officers on tribal lands. So this is also marks a very big expansion into the powers of what tribal authorities can investigate. Two other bills, the Not Invisible Act, signed into law in 2020, and Savannah's Act, also signed into law in 2020, aim to address the crisis by engaging law enforcement, tribal leaders, federal agencies, service providers, essentially everyone, to better coordinate across agencies, because that's the real problem here. It's about time. And there's an advisory committee which makes recommendations to the Department of Justice on best practices on how to respond to this crisis. Savannah's Act also provides tribal access to resources and information such as the Federal Criminal Information Database. And more importantly, it requires data collection related to missing and murdered Indigenous women and people, regardless of where they reside. So those numbers have to be inclusive now.
Yep. Again, this is one of those stories that ends with something on a positive note because people are finally listening. I mean, it's taken a lot of missing and murdered women for there to finally be attention paid to this, which is unfortunate. But I'm just glad that we see so much movement in the right direction to try to finally provide protection for women and just people in general who are living on Indian reservations.
There are some positive changes. We still need a lot more. For anyone else who's interested, you can donate to the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. Beyond that, you can keep educating yourself on these issues. Look at all of these websites. Share these stories. Share them in your book clubs. Talk about them in your everyday conversation with family and friends. There's a lot we can do to keep the conversation moving and really forward this cause. I want to thank everyone for being here today for this special episode. We really love Women's History Month, especially Women in Crime. It's a great place to showcase some of these incredible heroes. We appreciate you joining us today, and we'll catch you next time on Women in Crime.
Women in Crime is written and hosted by Megan Sachs and Amy Schlossberg. Our producer is James Varga. Script editing is by Abigail Bel Castro. Audio editing is by Siler Burr and Jose Alfonso. And music is by Dessert Media. If you enjoy the show, please remember to follow and leave a review. You can also support the show through Patreon, where you can get access to additional ad-free content such as exclusive full-length episodes, lectures, a book club, and virtual happy hours with Megan and Amy. For more information, visit patreon.com/womenandcrime.
Sources for today's episode include High Country News, BBC News, the Dateline episode Secrets of Spirit Lake, the Indian Law Resource Center, the National Crime Information Center, the Department of Justice, whitehouse.gov/factsheet, and the book Yellowbird by Sierra Crane Murdoch.